Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. King County and Seattle are looked to as leaders in the effort to prevent sex trafficking. But according to prosecuting attorney Dan Satterberg, the county has over 100 websites facilitating the sale of sex. A recent Seattle research survey conducted over a 24-hour period counted 8,700 online postings and responses concerning men seeking commercial sex. Of women who are prostituted, says King County Deputy Prosecutor Val Ritchie, quote, "We've come to realize that the vast majority, 80 to 90%, were sexually abused as children. Most youth were first engaged in this between the ages of 11 and 14, unquote. Who are the women and children being prostituted? Who are the men driven to purchase sex? And what is being done to help abuse victims and change the culture? Tonight on Speakers Forum, we present a recent panel discussion on the state of sex trafficking in our region today. It was organized by the nonprofit Stolen Youth. For the past 3 years, Stolen Youth has gathered leaders, experts, and activists to engage and educate the local community about the trafficking of children specifically. But this year, they broadened their focus. This event challenged individuals and the community to find ways to prevent sex trafficking from happening in the first place, especially by addressing demand. This recording starts with an audio excerpt from a video directed and narrated by Sue Corcoran. You'll find a link to the video and registration information for Stolen Youth's upcoming benefit luncheon on their website, stolenyouth.org. Stolen Youth presented this panel discussion at Town Hall Seattle on January 26, 2015. Please be advised, the following program contains themes of an adult nature.
How do you feel? Feel good?
Good, yeah.
Okay. All right, can you tell me your name, age, and where you're from?
I'm Lauren. I'm 14, and I'm from Mount Baker.
Cool. What is your best friend like?
She's cool. She's, like, chill. I don't know. That's just, like, how I'd explain her. She's really, like, she calms me down. Like, it's funny because I can be, like, more high-strung, and then we hang out, and she's just like, let's roll with it and just have fun, and that's really cool. I like to hang out with her.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Do you, like, have goals? Like, besides being a ballerina, are you going to college or something?
Yes, hopefully.
Do you know where you're going to college already?
Nope. Hopefully close, like UW or something. Uh-huh.
So you want to stay close. Why?
Because I can't leave my family. It'd be horrible.
You love your family.
Yeah. When I was really little, my mom said that I told her I was going to live with her the rest of my life.
Does she like that?
Yeah. She always reminds me, and I'm like, well, I don't know.
Maybe live nearby, but not with.
Yeah. Yeah, that might be a lot better.
Yeah. Boys. Are there boys around? What's up?
I'm really bad at flirting. I don't know. I need to, like, think about what I say before I say it. Like,
why?
Because things come out of my mouth. Like, do you like bread? In the middle of a random conversation about something totally different, because my mind goes blank, and I'm like, I just need to fill this silence, and it's a struggle.
Gotcha.
I'm on the struggle bus.
I like the struggle bus. So tell me about your family.
My mom lives in New York. My dad and my stepmom are here in Magnolia, Seattle. I live with my dad and my stepmom. My brother just went to college. My sister is 10. And we're pretty nice family. There's some stuff, but at the end of the day, we love each other. That's all that counts.
Can you tell me your favorite story or memory about your dad?
Well, I've never told anyone this before. when I was at summer camp. I was probably 12 or 13, and I remember talking to some of my girlfriends, and we decided we weren't gonna call our dads daddy anymore because we were too grown up or mature. And so my dad picks me up after 2 weeks away. And I really didn't want to go home, you know, because I had so much fun. But I saw him. I saw him waiting in our car. And I just ran toward him. And I remember I started crying a little. And I said under my breath at first, "Daddy." And then I got really loud, "Daddy." And I didn't even care when the other girls made fun of me for it. I know it's lame, but I think about that a lot.
I do not think that's lame. I think that's really beautiful.
Before we start tonight, most of you probably know that the average age of a young child in our community who is trafficked is 13 years old. That's the age of the young women and girls that you just saw in that video. I'm Zan Brookshire. I am very proud to be here as a representative of Stolen Youth. There are five other organizations, nonprofits. Hopefully you've had an opportunity to get to know some of the individuals. We don't have time to shout out for all of them. But if you have 1 minute left at the end of the evening and you can introduce yourself or meet them, pick up some of their brochures, you will find the work that they're doing incredibly effective and really inspiring. The video that you just saw was created by DNA Advertising, and it was produced by Sue Cochran and Von Piglet Productions. Next week, we are going to be launching hashtag not on our watch, and this video will be launched as part of our campaign. As many of you know, this month is the Human Trafficking Awareness Month. All of you in this room know how to do this. To make that a success, you have to like us on Facebook, you have to follow us on Twitter, and tell all of your friends. So I'm going to say it again, hashtag not on our watch, easy to remember. Last year, just about this time, we had a presentation in Town Hall to talk about the hideous problem in our community of young children and youth being sold for sex. We heard from the experts then. We heard from social workers. We heard from some of the people in the criminal justice system, and mostly we heard from nonprofits. 1 year later, we are going to present a very, very different program. Tonight, we're going to talk to you about the promising progress that has been made and can be made when we align the criminal justice system, nonprofits, the business sector, and individuals like all of you who really care about what happens to children in our community. We have created in Seattle and in King County a community coordinated response that is literally unduplicated anywhere else in the United States and probably the world. And it's working. We are making measurable progress to bring to the end one of the most serious issues of our day, the sexual exploitation of children. Tonight, you'll hear from a survivor. You'll hear from leaders in our city and county law enforcement. You'll hear from the business sector. You'll hear a very dynamic speaker who's flown in from London to address us about the work he's done on a global scale and what our businesses in this town, in this county, and our state can do to prevent children from being molested. And they're all working together. And you're going to hear from individuals who have instituted programs that are literally preventing children from being trafficked. We are leading the nation in Seattle. It's not the first time we've done that. We're all part of a community that has broken so many barriers, has changed so many social, has made such dramatic changes and problems. And we are doing some of the most promising prevention work in the world. Together, we will shift the culture of child exploitation, and we will change the demand for buying sex with children. I'm very pleased to introduce our first speaker. She's someone that many of you know, and if you know her, I can say with certainty that you respect her. Noelle Gomez is a tireless advocate for sexually exploited youth. She has changed the way survivors are treated here. She has created services that were never before imagined, much less available to survivors as they move forward. She's a co-founder of, and she's the director of Survivor Services at the Operation for Prostitute Survivors, or as we affectionately call them, OPS. Please welcome her.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Hi. Okay, I feel like this is in my face. Okay, so I'm Noelle Gomez, and I'm from the Organization for Prostitution Survivors and the Director of Survivor Services. As many of you know, I was prostituted and domestically trafficked starting as a youth. When I was finally out of that situation, I was beat down, didn't know anything else to do, didn't know where to go, didn't believe in myself, didn't think I had any choices, and I remained in the life for 15 years after that. I worked on the streets, I worked in escort services, and I worked in strip clubs. My life in prostitution was incredibly harmful to me. Even though at the time I rationalized it because of the money, I rationalized it because I didn't think I could do anything else and because I didn't think I was worth anything. So at the time, I didn't think about the harm that I would have to pay a huge price for later. An example of the harm that I experienced while in prostitution was from a client, a regular client, a John. We met, same time, same place, regular thing, but this time he had different plans for me. This time he planned to kill me. He tried to kill me, he strangled me, he thought I was dead. He hit me in the head with a baseball bat. He stun gunned me. He did everything imaginable to kill me, and I just wouldn't die. Finally, when he thought I was gone and he left, when I was found, the first thing the police asked me when they found me was, "What kind of drugs do you do?" My answer was, "None." They said to me, "Okay," while writing down a few things, "we'll call an ambulance." An ambulance came and got me. I ended up in the hospital, had some things done. I never heard from those police again. I don't believe there was even a report taken. I knew at that time that I would have to deal with this myself because there was no support elsewhere. That's just a very common story that I hear all the time from many, many different girls and many, many different women. Women are brutalized, raped, murdered, hurt, stalked, harassed, abused, all the time in this life, which is not really the life at all. I'm going to read a few quotes from a few survivors. This is from Maria while we were sitting in the Aurora Commons one night. She looked at me and she said, "Isn't it funny how these women go on Oprah and cry about being raped by one man?" She's like, "That stuff happens to us all the time. I can't even count how many times I've been raped." Quote. This is a quote from a 15-year-old girl that I've been working with since she was 12. She's been in the life since she was 12. She said to me, Girls nowadays, they're starting even younger. They just want money. Everything's built around money. They just want friends. It's really sad. They don't know about the harm that it's going to cause to their bodies and to their minds and to their emotions. They don't think about that at this time, at this age. It's really sad what we have to do. We have to do prostitution to have things, to have friends. After saying that, she told me that she wanted to do what I do when she gets older, to help women and girls get out of the life that she's been stuck in since she was 12. I could go on and on and on and on and on with these stories. I meet hundreds of women and hundreds of girls over the last years that I've been doing this. I don't want to forget the strip clubs here. In 1993, Minta Smith, otherwise known as Johnny, was murdered inside Sugar's nightclub, shot to death. The club closed for a few hours and reopened. Raven, another dancer at Rick's that I remember, was murdered and found in a dumpster not too far away, we assume by a customer. The customer that was found guilty for murdering Minta Smith is walking around today. I'm now going to read a short poem that was written by a survivor not very long ago. She probably wrote it maybe a week ago. 4 to 6 men a day, 6 days a week, 4 weeks a month, 12 months in a year, 1,728 encounters with men per year, 10 years in the life, 17,280 chances to reenact the abuse I experienced as a child. I hear that there are people that are fighting against us and fighting against what we are trying to do. I want to say this, and I want to make this very clear. I am here to help the women and the girls that are out there that are hurting and suffering because of this life that is so-called the life, okay? My organization was built to help these women and these girls. There's other organizations that are doing the same work, and there's a lot of direct service workers that are out there working right now. I just want to know, and I'm very curious about why it is people are saying this is not a problem. We are so busy. All of us, people at REST, people at the Aurora Commons, people at Youth Care, people at Friends of Youth, people at Auburn Youth Resources, all of us are so busy working with these young girls and these women that we don't even barely have time to live our own lives. So I stand here today as a survivor, and we're called survivors for a reason. To stop this, and from our little girls from thinking that they are going to grow up and have to get into a life like this so that they can fit in and have money and have the things that they think they have to have to be cool. It's not acceptable, and it's not acceptable that older people are saying that it is, because these young girls are listening. And we have to work with them. We want to work with them, and we're not making a lot of money doing it. But that's because we're not selfish. We care about the women and the girls that are hurting, and we plan to continue to do it. So good luck, and I hope somebody heard something that helped them understand more about the harm of prostitution and what is happening in our city and all around the nation. Thank you.
Wow. I'm very honored to introduce tonight Seattle City Attorney Pete Holmes. He's been serving our city as a city attorney since 2010. And he's going to share the stage with King County Prosecuting Attorney Dan Satterberg, who served as prosecuting attorney since 2007. Tonight, these two amazing leaders in our community are going to be speaking about the collaborative efforts that both city and county are taking to address this very, very important issue. And Dan will be speaking first. Thank you, Dan and Pete.
Thank you. And thank you, Noel. I think we wanted to interrupt you and give you some applause about three or four times during your talk. So can we do it one more time? Thank you very much. Because Noel is speaking the truth that so many people in our community do not want to hear. And even well-meaning people, who, when they hear that you're working to reduce the harm of prostitution, they'll say things like, well, it's the world's oldest profession. And they say that just because it's an instinctive thing that they say. And they say it also to kind of tell you, well, don't work too hard and don't expect too much because, you know, it's been around forever. But the truth is, it's not the world's oldest profession. The world's oldest profession is slavery, selling one person to another. And we got rid of that. In many places, it is no longer acceptable, it's no longer tolerated, it's no longer something that we would ever accept in our community, yet slavery is going on right now in our community. There are over 100 websites in the King County area right now where sex is being sold. A recent 24-hour survey by Arizona State University found that just in the city of Seattle, in 24 hours, there were 8,700 separate individual postings and responses by men seeking commercial sex. 8,700 in a 24-hour period. Had about 27,000 in King County, if you extrapolate that. It's happening. It's underground. It's an ugly part of our community that people would just as soon not deal with. But you're here tonight, so you want to deal with it. And you are the bright spot. You are the tipping point, because law enforcement can't do this alone. I've been in the prosecution field for 30 years, and I remember the first time I was handed a file on a juvenile prostitution case, and she was 15, and I was only 24. And I didn't know that that happened in our community, and I felt ridiculous putting this case into court, because she needed so much more than a conviction and probation. She needed so much more to get away from her pimp and to get away from the buyers. Well, we've come a long way in 30 years. Today, our goal is to identify women who are being prostituted and treat them as the victims that they are and give them the services that they so desperately need. We are there to look at to go after the pimps who are exploiting, and we have very strong laws and very tough approaches to them. But what's been missing in this attack on the supply is equal emphasis on the demand. And that's changing. Together with the Organization for Prostitution Survivors, the King County Prosecutor's Office has received a grant from the Demand Abolition Group, and together we are working not just to change the way that we handle cases, but really to change our entire culture. And you are here as additional ambassadors in that mission. Women and children who are being prostituted do not need convictions. They do not need criminal records or probation. They need our love, our compassion, and our care. They need the best services that we can provide. Pimps, yes, we're going to continue to prosecute them. But the buyers of sex, well, it's time for them to be held accountable. No more diversions. No more John School. In fact, I don't use the word Johns anymore. I suggest you don't either, because it undermines and undervalues the danger that they are to our community. And besides, I know some guys named John who are pretty nice guys, and it's not fair to them. The buyers of sex are what drives the demand to exploit our children, to take these beautiful young girls like you saw in this video and put them through a living hell. It is ironic, Noel, that they call it the life, because I don't think it's a life at all. I think it's a nightmare. And these buyers are going to now face real risks. You know, the internet has been the game changer here. No longer do men have to summon the courage to walk the track in a tough part of town. Now with a couple clicks of the mouse, they can order sex. And they have this sense of entitlement that because they have money, they can now own another human being. Well, that's not normal, that's not okay, that's not acceptable. And what we can do in law enforcement is to begin to reinforce that shift. So if you get arrested for soliciting sex from an adult, you're going to get a conviction on your record. It's going to go on your record. And there's no more John school. Now you're going to go have to face a much more rigorous program, and we'll hear about that in just a moment. And if you solicit an underage commercial sexual encounter with someone who you think is a minor, and you show up, and instead of being one of these young girls, it's a police detective, you face a presumptive prison sentence, and you face a $5,000 fine. And last year, thanks to the leadership of Senior Deputy Val Ritchie in my office, working with the Seattle Police Department and eight other suburban areas, so this is Seattle is not the only place doing it. We've got eight other departments helping us with this. We filed cases on 50 adult men who thought they were arranging to have sex with a real 15-year-old girl. And it, 50 is a start. It's a start. In many of those cases, in order to arrive at a negotiated plea deal where they pled guilty to promoting prostitution, a felony, as well as communicating with a minor, also a registrable sex offense felony, and paid a $5,000 fine, we made them go through a sexual deviancy evaluation, and where many of these men admitted, obviously this wasn't the first time that they'd done it, many of them had done it hundreds of times, and many of them felt compelled to do it, and they weren't proud of it, but they had a compulsive disorder. There are things that we need to do to acknowledge that the buyers here are worth our attention. They're not innocent boys. It's not boys will be boys. But these are men, because of the internet, who are respected members of our community. They're businessmen on vacation to Seattle, thinking that our good coffee is not enough to enjoy when they get here. They are men. We found men in positions of authority, ministers, high school teachers, businessmen, and others. They deserve our attention, and they deserve as much promotion as we can give to their plight so that other men who may be tempted to do what they do will be deterred instead. So we're really making a dramatic change, and it's happening at rapid speed because we're being introduced to people like Noel and understanding the damage and the hurt and the harm that's happening here. And yes, there's back, you know, if you read the comments, there's people online who will say this is no big deal, and this is, you know, the men who do this have their own support group on the internet, and they like to call themselves hobbyists. They are hobbyists who happen to exploit, abuse, and rape other human beings. They minimize the damage, but we can change all that. We can change that. And I know that there's a small group of women who are saying, hey, this is okay. This is a profession that I chose. This doesn't hurt anybody. And my answer to that is that if 1% of women who are being sold in prostitution are happy with that life, if 1%, I don't think I've ever met anyone, but if there's 1% of them who are, that doesn't mean that we should turn our backs on the 99% who continue to be abused in our community. It's right for us to be here and to fight this fight. So thank you for being here to lock arms with us, to change our culture, to change what some people view as normal and acceptable, and to shine the light on the harm that it really does to our community. With that, I'll turn it over to you, Pete.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Noel. Thank you, Zan. And thank all of you for being here tonight. You know, for this part of the segment, I want to emphasize a real simple phrase, that words matter. I cannot do the work that I do in conjunction with Dan Satterberg in the county prosecutor's office and make that understandable, make it make sense to everyone out here who wants to tackle a problem without trying to just explain a little bit about why words matter. And so Dan, for instance, is the felony prosecutor. He also deals with juveniles who run afoul of the criminal justice system. I deal with misdemeanors and adults. Now, with that simple bifurcation, those two things, it's amazing how our laws right now involving prostitution are wielded in this state and how we're actually trying to make a difference in the way that we use the terminology. Dan's already said that John's is too sanitized. They're sex buyers. They're sex buyers. And we don't want to use the word prostitute as a noun. They're prostituted people. And when we start to recognize the dynamics of this trade, this industry, if you will, and start to align our jurisdictions, our laws, and our words, the words that we use to talk about this with our children, with our family, I think then we're going to start to see some real progress. You know, prostitution crimes, just together, selling and buying, have been treated by the criminal justice system across the globe in a very lopsided manner. Ask any officer, ask any prosecutor, they'll tell you that traditionally the female side of the equation is arrested and prosecuted at approximately 2 to 3 times the male side. 3/4 of the arrests and prosecutions, 2/3, will be women, and the much smaller percentage will be men. So a couple of years ago, the acting police chief here in Seattle came to me and said, "We're in the middle of a recession, but can we try and flip that number?" The Seattle Police Department had already renamed the vice and narcotics section into two sections, or narcotics sections and a vice and high-risk victims section. That, again, words matter. Starting to recognize that this is not a victimless crime, as it's called. There are real victims. And we're starting to recognize, finally, that often the women involved in this are there. They're under coercion. And even if they're an adult that comes to my office, they maybe started the life at age of 11, 12, 13. And if we want to pretend that something magic happened the day they turned 18, then it's what it is. It's pretend. It's words. You may have read recently that the Seattle City Council unanimously changed the word patronizing a prostitute, a misdemeanor under the Seattle Municipal Code, to what it simply is, sexual exploitation. The council is to really be commended for not only their action, but in the debate that has ensued since then. And just this week, Senator Jeannie Caldwell has introduced a bill in the Washington legislature that would take the purchasing side of this transaction — I'm being purposefully sanitized — but the patronizing of a prostitute, which is still the title under state law, is now no longer a simple misdemeanor as it is the act of prostitution. It's now, if this passes, and I urge you to reach out to your legislators to make this a gross misdemeanor. In other words, instead of a 90-day sentence, possibly up to 364-day sentence. And while we're at it, I will, without prolonging the theme here, words matter. Perhaps you're wondering what happens with the use of a word, a registered sex offender, that phrase. All of these crimes I'm describing do not qualify you for the sexual offender registry. But we could make it that way. We could say that buying sex is an offense if you're convicted, especially the gross misdemeanor. Instead of it having to involve a juvenile, it's just the simple act, the gross misdemeanor of buying sex requires you to register as a sex offender. That's not in the hopper now down at the legislature, but it could be if enough people ask the legislators to take that step. I also want to talk about how, very quickly, and wrap this up, how simply the way that we implement our existing laws can make a difference. When the chief came to me and asked if we could change the way we arrest and prosecute, if we could flip those ratios, one of the things we were worried about in my office is, all right, we can go with much higher penalties that we'll demand for a plea for first-time offenders. And there was a great deal of concern that we'll end up with hung juries. We'll have more people saying, to heck with that, I'm going to go to trial, try my luck. Well, we were surprised. They weren't going to trial. They were taking the deal. And it started to make us realize that maybe we could push harder here. And so, effective now in the city of Seattle, in my office, that even the first-time sex buyer, even as a simple misdemeanor, assuming that the legislature doesn't make it a gross misdemeanor, we're going to require that you plead guilty. And if you want to roll the dice, then you will go through a trial. If there's probable cause for that arrest, you will go to trial, and we will work hard to get that conviction, and we'll see what will happen. But it's all part of a greater program, the Buyer Beware program that Dan talked about. Thanks to the Abolition Coalition, we're able to get that word out that there is a real significant chance if you come to Seattle to buy sex, there's a good chance you're going to stay here a lot longer than you planned. I'll close by saying that even while we're trying to really go at this logically, we're trying to use our public resources in the way that makes sense. That's really what this comes down to. We're stewards of your dollars, and we're trying to attack the demand side, because arresting all those women for years and decades and prosecuting them didn't get the job done. And we think that this new approach will make a big difference. At the same time, we have to make sure that when we do encounter the women in the life, that we are providing services to help them get out of the life, that we are using sufficient levers, whether it's community court and a prosecution that involves aligning them with social services that will address their needs, or at the outset, using a new program that we have here in Seattle and King County that Dan has been a wonderful partner on, the Law Enforcement Assistant Diversion Program, where we can credibly tell women, we're going to make sure that you're getting services, but continuing in the life is not optional. Instead of taking you to the King County Jail, we'd like to take you to someone who can help, a safe place where you can go. And that is simply a matter of rolling up our sleeves, talking to each other, working together, and that's what's happening right now in Seattle and King County. So thank you all for being here.
My name is Val Ritchie, and I'm a deputy prosecutor with King County. And one of the things that you just heard from Dan and from Pete was about the changing culture in law enforcement. And I want to show you a visual representation of exactly what we're talking about. This chart here shows in blue juveniles who were charged with prostitution. And you can see in 2009... that there was a lot of them. That was the approach that we had at that time. That was the approach that law enforcement had. And you can see in red the men who have been arrested and charged with trying to buy sex from children. And you can see in 2009 how few of them there were. Well, over the last 5 and 6 years, we have completely flipped that narrative. And you can see here... You can see here what the jeopardy that these men are now facing. And this is due to some of the great work by the Seattle Police Department and the other law enforcement agencies, including the Sheriff's Office around the county, as well as to the prosecutors who are working hard on these cases. This is the culture shift that we're talking about. And now we can start to move that out beyond to the community. To that end, we're here tonight to have a panel discussion with several great leaders in our community. You've heard tonight about the vast problem that this is, and it's not a problem that we can resolve by arresting our way out of it. It's a problem that we really need to implement some community-based solutions. To that end, we've established this program called Buyer Beware. It's a program, it's a partnership among the Organization for Prostitution Survivors, Businesses Ending Slavery and Trafficking, Seattle Against Slavery, and our host tonight, Stolen Youth. And it's an opportunity for all of us to come together and try to create some collaborative responses to the problem. What's come out of that partnership are a number of creative interventions beyond law enforcement, beyond police tactics, to community-based solutions. And our next three presenters are going to talk about some of those. They're going to talk about why focusing on demand is important, and they're going to talk about some of the responses that have been created in our community to address it. Peter Qualiatin, on my far left, is one of the co-founders with Noel of the Organization for Prostitution Survivors, and he's the director of men's programs. OPS provides services for survivors, but another great thing that they do is provide programming for men who are in caught up in buying sex and to try to work with those men to see a different way through life. Robert Beiser in the middle is the executive director of Seattle Against Slavery. And Seattle Against Slavery is a community coalition bringing people together in the Seattle area since 2009. And it's bringing together people who care about trying to stop human trafficking. And Mar Bretman, to my left, is the executive director of Businesses Ending Slavery and Trafficking. And this is an organization focused on engaging businesses to do just that, to end slavery and trafficking. So I'm going to start with you, Peter. And we've heard a little bit from Noel and Dan and Pete about the need to address demand and their reasoning about why that's important. You've been working in this field for some 20 or 25 years, and I would like to ask you first to tell us your perspective on why is demand important? Why is it important to focus on that from a community-based perspective?
Because prostituted women and children are members of our community too. And prostituted women and children deserve the same right to equality that we all do. And what I've learned over the past 25 years of doing this work is that prostitution is a harmful practice. And it's a system of gender-based violence. It's by and large men's violence against women. I came to this work from the domestic violence movement. And so I think that I take a lot of hints from the DV movement and recognize that in the early days of domestic violence work, the effort was very much weighted on law enforcement and the criminal justice system. And I think what happened around the 80s was that really the community started recognizing that law enforcement alone couldn't solve this problem and started to move towards what's called a coordinated community response that included multiple complementary interventions aimed at reducing the incidence of domestic violence, another form of gender-based violence. And so I think when we look at the issue of prostitution, we can really take a lesson from work that's been done on DV and work that's been done on sexual assault and recognize that prostitution is a harmful practice. It's a system of gender-based violence. Most women, as we've heard today so many times, have entered the commercial sex industry as teenagers. Most have experienced sexual abuse as children. Most are pimped, coerced, and compelled into the life. Prostitution exists because of poverty. Prostitution exists because of racism, because of violence. And that the stigma and judgment that women in prostitution and children in prostitution have historically experienced have compounded the difficulty of accessing services. And so I think that I am kind of pinching myself here today to hear the criminal justice system speaking my language. Years ago, when I got my head turned around by some survivors who said, "You say you're working against domestic violence and sexual assault. Well, what about prostitution?" And I started listening to their stories and hearing about what they experienced in the life and recognizing this as a system of gender-based violence, I started to approach law enforcement. Back then, I was in Portland and other folks in the criminal justice system, and I couldn't get an ear. I figured that they weren't listening to the women that I was hearing from because of the judgment and stigma and continued criminalization of those women, but perhaps they would listen to me. And it just wasn't true. And it's taken 25 years, but I'm really glad that this day is here. Like domestic violence and sexual assault, sex buying is not just an individual problem. It's not just a problem with individual men who are individually purchasing sex. It's also a social problem. And the problem is not the victims. The problem is not the survivor's problem. It becomes her problem, as Noel so eloquently spoke to you before, and how so many others who access ops services can attest to. The problem is not just the individual men who buy sex either. The problem is that many men feel entitled to pay for sex. And there's a difference here. We often talk about the issue of demand, but I like to reframe it and talk about the issue of men's entitlement because I think it is a significant part of this problem. I was a co-author on a research study in 2011 that looked at 100 men in Boston who bought sex and compared them to 100 men in Boston who did not buy sex. And there were a lot of interesting things in that study, but one of the most interesting things for me was that of those men who do not buy sex, many of them said it was okay for those that do. So when I speak of the issue of men's entitlement, I speak to this. This is also reflected in a phenomenon that I've heard many times from women in the life. Many times I've heard the story that they would work bachelor parties. They would get a call from the best man. They would show up at the party. They would get into a room with the groom. And the groom would say to them, "I don't want to do anything. But don't tell the guys out there." What is it going to take for men to have the ethical courage to be able to stand up and tell the guys out there? What is it going to take for men to get over our fear of other men and support our sisters? It's going to take a coordinated community response to commercial sexual exploitation. It wasn't just a rhetorical question. Finally, I get to say that. It's actually happening. So Buyer Beware is implementing multiple complementary interventions across the spectrum of prevention and intervention that are designed to reduce sex buying. As part of this, I have instituted, along with others at OPS, a new model of sex buyers intervention program that is not a diversion program, but rather a condition of sentencing. It's not a 6 hours and ha-ha, wink-wink, nod-nod, out the other door. It's a 10-week program with 2 individual sessions of motivational interviewing, followed by 8 weeks of classes, followed by a voluntary support group for as long as the men need this. This is a problem with men. And the thing that makes... And it's a problem for men. The thing that makes me crazy about this issue is that it serves no one. I meet these men and I do these interviews with them and I hear their stories and I hear their ambivalence about buying sex. And I recognize that they're miserable and they're destroying other people's lives with their misery. It's needless suffering. It does not have to happen. So I think with understanding how this is culturally constructed through institutions of manhood, through male bonding, through the use of pornography, through the influence of the all-male peer group, through the subordination of women to men, girls to boys, through gender socialization, we learn this behavior. It's not surprising to me that some men buy sex. What's surprising to me is that more men don't. And I think it speaks to men's humanity and ability to really deal with what we learn about gender socialization, to be able to take that in and to be able to learn to treat women with equality and respect. And we got to pull our brothers along with us. So, in addition to the Sex Buyers Intervention Program, we also recognize that we need to work at systems levels. We need to engage multiple sectors through awareness efforts and the creation of policies and procedures that treat prostitution as a form of gender-based violence. We need to do this with our community partners. We need to do this with folks in the business community. And I'm lucky enough to work with folks in the criminal justice system, in the business community, community-based organizations, working together on this issue, coordinating a community response across those multiple sectors that ultimately are going to reduce the judgment and stigma against prostituted people and help shift the community, institutional, cultural, and social norms that support sex buying. So I'm very proud to sit up here tonight with y'all.
Thank you very much, Peter. Robert, I want to turn to you. Peter's kind of put out a call to action there about community involvement. How has Seattle Against Slavery gotten involved in this effort?
We've been really excited and honored, honestly, to have Organization for Prostitution Survivors give us the call. We're an anti-trafficking organization, and they said, go take this work out into the community, try to bring together people who want to work on the issue of the money that's going into the hands of pimps and traffickers. Because ultimately, that's what we're talking about here. That's the motivation. Men's money paying for all of these horrible things to happen. If the money wasn't out there, if men weren't buying, then the problem would stop. And so we've got three programs that are currently up and running that we think can help address this and call to men to share with other men that this isn't something that we should be doing, that this is violence that we can and should stop. So the first one is a high school-based prevention curriculum. With the girls who are in the classroom, we have very honest conversations about the risks of trafficking. As Noelle said, there are some myths about this out there, and so we bring survivor voices to them and help them stand up against trafficking and know how to support their friends and those in the student community in case this is something that comes up. And with the boys, we have an honest conversation with them about what they could be causing to someone else if they're buying sex, about who they want to be as young men, that they can create safety for other people, that they can create community instead of hurting other people, and that acting on behalf of other people to keep them safe is a strong and honorable thing to do. So that high school-based intervention program, that's something that we're just piloting for the first time this year, and we're really excited to see it expand throughout King County. Now, the second thing that we're working on is understanding that, from Peter's research, the first time most men buy sex, I know this is kind of distracting, but I'll explain it. What they found in that research was the first time most men buy sex is when they're 21 years old. And if you want to reach a 21-year-old guy to let him know something, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, that's where they seem to get all of their education from. They're not opening up newspapers. Honestly, they're not coming to Seattle Against Slavery events, by and large. And so we worked with this community coalition to come up with the type of messages, they're called memes, that are funny little messages that help get the idea across. That if you're going to go and buy sex, that's not a cool thing to do. That could be trafficking. That could be hurting someone. And if you share this, that's a good thing to do. Let your friends who are guys know. And then the past 2 months, we've reached 52,000 men aged 18 to 24 in just King County with messages like this. Now, the third thing that we're doing is honestly the thing that we're pretty good at, which is community organizing. We have a lot of people in this community who care about the issue of trafficking. We have churches, synagogues, mosques. We have community groups like Rotary Clubs and Junior League who, when they hear about the issue of trafficking, they want to know what they can do about it. And I'll be honest, 2 years ago, we did not say, tell everyone you know, if they're buying sex, they're supporting trafficking. There's the possibility that every person who gets sold for sex is being forced to do it, so you never want to take that chance. We have churches telling their youth groups this message now. We have community groups putting this in their literature that they hand out at their luncheons. It's an incredible thing to see, and we had over 30 community partners work on the issue of demand in the last year alone. So that's a great achievement.
So, Robert, these sound like excellent interventions on the issue of prevention. What kinds of things are being done to try to address what's happening right now?
So, as you heard earlier, a lot of the demand, a lot of men buying sex has shifted online. And we recognize that for some men, they've grown up in these cultures and in these institutions that have really taught them this is an okay thing to do. So when they go to buy sex, we have launched a new campaign where when they're searching online, on Google, and on Bing, they're going to see something a little bit different. There are 100 websites that sell sex, and men are putting in keywords to try to get to those sites. They're going to see a message that says, you want to buy sex? If she's underage, you'll be a registered sex offender, $5,000 fine, and you're a felon.
where they will receive a message. Maybe they don't know about the harm. So it says, beatings, rapes, murder are daily realities in prostitution. You don't want to buy into that. And the third thing that they're going to see messages about is support that's available. Because as Peter said, some of these men are coming to this issue from a really dark place in themselves, and they want support, and they want to stop. And so this is a new campaign. We've already had over 1,000 men hit this website in 2 weeks alone. And I'll just say, that's from 60,000 men in 2 weeks searching for terms that are directly related to young people in prostitution.
Thank you, Robert. Mar, we've heard a little bit about intervening with men through classes. We've heard about high school programs and intervening online. Dan mentioned earlier that there's a broad spectrum of men who've been caught buying sex, including leaders in our community and people in business. What can be done on the business side? How can businesses get involved and engage on this issue?
Sure. So when it comes to law enforcement getting involved or social service providers getting involved or folks like Seattle Against Slavery, it's really obvious, I think, to most people why they need to get involved in this issue. Businesses, it's a little less obvious why. And so we've done some research, which I am very excited to be unveiling tonight, which looks at the men who buy sex. So this is specifically men who attempted to buy sex from minors, and you will see the top industries that these men come from are construction, information technology, manufacturing. The strange one right there that I'm not sure what happened to is government, which is 12%, retail, transportation, and warehousing, and then all the other sectors you can think of. This is the reason that we've got to reach out to the business community to engage them in efforts to prevent trafficking in our community. So what this shows is that this crime is a risk to every single business in every sector in our community. But when I looked at this and I saw, okay, so information technology is 13%, well, this is Seattle, right? So sure, of course it's 13% because almost all of our people in Seattle are employed in information technology. So we thought, well, we better look at sort of how does this kind of data compare to actual enrollment data or employment data. So this next slide will show how what the employment data actually is in our county. So for example, information technology, 7% of people who are employed in King County are employed in the IT sector. So you'll see 13% are buyers, or 13% of the buyers are from IT. So that is a really large percentage. Across the board, from the transportation to the right, goes in order of sort of the rate of sex buying in each industry. So transportation is the worst, then construction, then IT, compared to the number of people who are actually working in that industry. So if we're going to solve the problem of sex trafficking, it could not be more clear that we have got to have businesses at the table. But Val, you asked, what can businesses actually do? And so in the coming months, we are starting an initiative to bring together both the private and the public sector to ask employers to take a stand against human trafficking, to commit themselves to say, we will join together as a community, as this community, and recognize that we want to stop this crime from happening. Just think of the shift that we would see if our men and our employers and our women came together and said, our community affirms the value of every human life. Sex trafficking is not acceptable.
You've outlined an opportunity for businesses to get involved, but this seems like a challenging thing for businesses to actually take on. What level of confidence do you have that we can engage businesses to try to address this problem?
Good. Our keynote speaker is going to speak even more eloquently, far more eloquently than I can, to this issue. But I'll give you one quick example. So a couple years ago, we wanted to start working with the hotel industry. If you all were at Town Hall last year, I told you that we realized that the majority of sex trafficking cases occur in hotels, so we wanted to work with the hotel industry. A lot of people said it wouldn't work. But we went to them. We went to the Washington Lodging Association, Seattle Hotel Association. We presented the issue in a very clear business case as to why it is in their interest to take this very difficult issue on. And I am incredibly proud of our hotel industry because they have demonstrated compassion and taken action like no other tourism industry in the U.S. Several of them are here tonight. I know I saw David Watkins and Bill Wise with the Washington Lodging Association, the Seattle Hotel Association, Visit Seattle, and numerous others. We've all worked very hard together to get training out to hoteliers throughout Washington State. We've now trained 525 people in five counties in Washington. We're doing another training in Clark County this next month. So then researchers came along from University of Washington because we were wondering, okay, is this actually effective? Is this creating any change? Can business standards actually change what happens in the community? And here's what they found. They found that there was a dramatic shift in attitudes just through going through one training. Before the training, almost half said that prostitution was a victimless crime. After the training, only 5% said that. These are our hoteliers. Before the training, 8% had found some cases of trafficking in their hotels. After the training, they started looking for it. And so 44% found it. And they've changed their behaviors. They started contacting law enforcement. So this just illustrates businesses can make a tremendous difference in changing what's happening in our community and having an impact on social issues. And it's through their operations that they can make a difference, not just through their giving. So sex trafficking, unfortunately, involves a number of businesses. I've illustrated this here, but it poses all sorts of risks, from risk to public reputation, risks that are legal in nature, so legal risks, financial risks. And I'm going to illustrate all those risks in one piece of data. The Organization for Prostitution Survivors has started doing some research for us, and it's very initial data, but they found that 3 out of 4 prostituted people said that they had met clients at their businesses, on company properties. This exposes businesses to incredible liability. This is not something businesses want to be part of. So businesses have this power to create change. Employer standards have a power to influence what happens in individual lives, to shape standards of individual lives. So we want to work with businesses to make this commitment, and then we want to give them a roadmap, make it really easy for them to be able to implement their commitment within their operations. So if you're interested, if you work with a business or you want to help us promote this, please stop by our table as you are leaving, and we'd be happy to get in touch with you. We'd love to work with you.
Thank you so much. You know, I've been working in the criminal justice arena for quite some time now, and there's a lot of opportunity there to do good work in this area. But I hope what you're seeing from the presentations we heard tonight is that there are so many checkpoints before the act of exploitation where we can be involved. Whether it's high school classes, engaging high school students, whether it's engaging businesses, whether it's working with men in classes after they've been caught, whether it's online deterrence, whether it's any of those options that you've heard about tonight, there is so much that can be done so that I don't have a job. That's what we want, okay? We want that exploitation to end. Before we welcome David Arklas, I just would like one big round of applause for Peter, Robert, and Mar. Thank you so much.
I'm introducing David Arklas, president of CDI Corporation, and the CEO and founder of ArcLight Consulting. Before he did that work, he worked for 25 years at Manpower Group, where he was the president of global corporate and government affairs. So under his leadership, Manpower became one of the leading companies in the world to take on the issue of human trafficking. They were one of the first supplier companies to sign the Athens Ethical Principles. And they have continued to do this work, which is just fabulous. So Mr. Arklitz has continued to, after leaving Manpower, he's continued to deal in humanitarian issues, to really advocate for humanitarian issues. He is currently the member of the Global Business Coalition Against Trafficking, or GBCAT. In addition, I am very humbled and proud to say that Mr. Arklitz was a founding member of BEST, and he is the first person, I think, who said to me, "We have got to get businesses to start working on demand." So he has inspired us and inspired so many people, and I have no doubt that he will inspire you tonight on what businesses can do to prevent this crime. So, Mr. Arklitz, come on up. He wants to run around.
I like getting in amongst the enemy. And now you're thinking, what on earth is this British business guy doing at a meeting like this? I'd like to correct your thought process. I'm Swiss. I was educated in England. At least they called it education. It was more ritual, humiliation, and beating, but very character-forming. So why am I here? I came because Ma told me, "David, you've got to be in Seattle. You helped me start something, and now you've got to help me finish it." I'm a business guy, so I look at things from a business perspective and try and work out really systematic ways that we can solve issues. They say that there are two important times in your life. One is when you're born. The other time is when you discover the purpose that you were born for. That purpose for me actually happened after many, many years in business. So I end up running a $22 billion company. It's all going great, and I'm thinking, one of these days I can retire and buy a Greek island, and especially after the kind of Greek economic situation, I can get one of those cocktails with a pretty little kind of umbrella in it and watch the sun go down every night. And then my chief of staff walks into my office and says, "David, the Queen of Sweden is on the phone for you." And I said, "Right, who's after that, the King of Prussia?" And she said, no, it's really Queen Sylvia. And I said, "Well, I suppose I'd better take the call." And I took the call, and Queen Sylvia said, "David, there are a few very influential women that we've got together, and we have decided that business isn't involved enough in stopping the abuse of human beings, especially the abuse of women and children for the purpose of sexual abuse." And it was some pretty heavy hitters, like the woman that's now running the IMF, Christine Lagarde, who was a French politician at the time, and a few other women. And you know what groups of women are like when they get onto something. They kind of go right after you, and there is no way out. They corner you, and they go, "You will." And I said, okay, what's the issue? And she spent about an hour telling me about the dreadful abuse of women and children for the purpose of sexual exploitation, saying that they wanted to get a meeting together and get thousands of businesses signed up to stop or encourage stopping human trafficking, modern-day slavery, and especially the abuse of women and children. So I guess the fishing line went out, and I got just hooked in a little bit and started to work with them. We had a meeting in Athens, which resulted in starting a foundation funded by some businesses in Europe initially and the Middle East called End Human Trafficking Now. And within 4 years, End Human Trafficking Now had signed up 40,000 companies globally to A, check and verify their supply chains for non-abuse of migrant workers, forced laborers, and secondly, to address their human resource policies and financial T&E, travel and expense policies, to say, if you work for my company, if you work for our company, it's against our values that you abuse human beings on business time. That's where it started. And what we realized is, and by the way, you've got a real problem in this county, 27,000 men a day trying to solicit women for sexual abuse or children for sexual abuse. Discount 7,000 of them, say they don't get lucky, as they would put it. Let's say it's only 20,000 a day. Multiply that number by 100, $150, You've got in one county in the United States here a $1.6 billion US dollar criminal syndicate running something that you hate. Now, I do have to say, with all of the kind of committed missionaries, advocates, the legal organizations, your local government, in my opinion, you're doing one of the best jobs in the United States, but it isn't good enough. So I found out that there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of women and children being trafficked into modern-day slavery for sexual abuse around the world. So we've tried to do something about that. We went from the End Human Trafficking Organization and persuaded big American corporations to get involved, Fortune 500 companies like Delta, ExxonMobil, Microsoft, and others, to start something in the US called Global Business Coalition Against Trafficking, which is a safe location for big corporations to go and say, what the hell is this problem? What are we doing about it? How can we get involved? Now, as I said to you, I'm a business guy, and I go out there and I talk to businesses about getting involved in a business way, not in a, hey, this is the right humanitarian thing to do, and none of us would stand for this, would we? So you should get involved. Forget it. Businesses don't work like that. Shareholders don't like it. It costs a lot of money to do this stuff, so the only way to approach business is to go to a business with what they all call, and I call, a return on investment calculation. Dead simple. In other words, if you do this, you'll make more money. It took me a while to get through that, because the first thing I did was I went to my company, Manpower, and went to the board and said, we're going to get involved in this, and we're going to stop human trafficking on a global basis. And the board said, how much are we going to spend on this every year? I said, oh, not much, maybe $15, $20 million. And the response was, are you certifiably insane? That comes straight off our bottom line. So I went away and I thought a little bit, and I started an experiment in one of our countries called Sweden. And in Sweden, we started to work with the government, working with local not-for-profit organizations, trying to get employees involved in doing something, getting connected to the issue, communicating, getting them to help, using their expertise in training and developing and counseling people to help survivor organizations, etc. Now, we found out in 1 year, which was my experiment year with Sweden, and we had about a $200 million company there, so it was not small, that we managed to get employees to be so involved in this, their belief in the company and our values rocketed through the roof. What happened was that employees became more engaged with our mission and our values. What this resulted in was a reduction in what you Americans call attrition in the company. What's attrition? How many people leave? I worked out globally based on the Swedish numbers where we'd reduced attrition by 10% in 1 year. If I could reduce attrition in an 18 million person organization globally by 1% in a year, I saved the company, guess how much? $250 million. Where we didn't have to replace people, their productivity went up, the whole thing. So I went back to the board and I said, hey, dummies, what do you think of that? And they went, oh, we like the look of this one. Let's get the whole organization involved. So we did that, and then we started going out to other big corporations and explaining the issue, the problem, communicating. Because the average response I would get from chair people was, what problem? I'd call up car companies like, I can't say any names, like General Motors, and say to them, the chairman, what are you doing about verifying your supply chain and making sure your HR policies say it's against your principles for men to use women and children when they're traveling on your company books? And they said, what problem? And so the GM guy said, just read your email I've just sent through to you. I gave him photographs of his company suppliers, two down in the supply chain, abusing slaves in Brazil in charcoal pits to make pig iron, to make into steel, which was sent to Detroit to make the cars. And then I said, let's get into this one as well. We've done a survey of some of your people that travel for procurement purposes for iron, steel, other commodities throughout South America, and they weren't just procuring things to make cars. They were procuring women and children in hotels when they were traveling. So the chairman went, I'm shocked and stunned, and yes, we'd better get involved with this. So ROI, return on investment calculations, are good to get corporations and companies involved. The other one is threatening them with public exposure, which I love doing. So what are we trying to do here? We're trying to get as many small to medium-sized enterprises involved as we can. It's a much tougher job going to an SME and saying, you need to get involved, and you've got this little retail store on the corner. What can you do? What's it worth to you? How can this be important? So we've got a great case, and Mar is working in trying to get a community of small to medium-sized enterprises to make a basis of changing the way that businesses help the efforts of the fantastic, amazing, awesome people that you've heard from tonight. Business must get involved with this. If any of you run businesses, if any of you are in business, go to your employers and say, you must be involved in this. What difference can business make? A huge difference, if you'd forgive me for saying. I worked out as I go around the world, and I travel 300 days a year, that there are two things where human beings are. One is government, everywhere that human beings are. The other one is employment and business. If you can get government, law, and business implementation and commitment together, you can solve virtually any problem. One thing that I'm extremely proud of is that, and I don't make kind of high-level objectives, my first one in this area was to say, I'm going to change the whole of the United Nations to get aligned on this. And they invited me to talk to the General Assembly and the whole thing. But by the way, you know, it's tough work with the UN organizations to get them to change anything. When you speak to the General Assembly, it's like reading Shakespeare to chickens. You know, they're kind of going like this the whole time. But we've done a great amount of work with UN Office of Drugs and Crime, with Interpol, with other international organizations to try and get them aligned. So then I decided I was going to change a whole country. And I decided to pick a small one that's not very sophisticated and hasn't been around very long. I thought, I'm going to change the United Kingdom completely. So what we did was we went and did an analysis of this issue of sex trafficking, of the abuse of women and children, as well as forced labor, forced migrant worker labor in the UK. And we found out that the issue, if you make it a legal issue, was split between 7 different ministries in the UK. You know, things like child abuse in one, immigration issues over here, asylum seeker status over here, the abuse of children. You know, it was all over the place. So we looked at that, and we couldn't get anybody to agree on the statistics. Nobody. So I said, right, we're getting a business consortium together. We're going to fund the most forensic analysis of this problem of modern-day slavery, the abuse of women and children in the United Kingdom. So we spent 7 months with one of the best think tanks in the UK called the Centre for Social Justice, independent organisation, gave them a bunch of money, guided them, helped them, gave them business processes to help their capacity, and got this report back. We got the report. And then we looked through it, and I said, well, the evidence is evident, the evidence. I like that. The evidence was evident. And it's right in front of you, and the report was this thick, and it said, slavery has not disappeared in the United Kingdom. The abuse of human beings has not disappeared in the United Kingdom, one of the so-called sophisticated societies on this planet. So the next thing we did was we went and approached a bunch of law lords, as they're called in the UK, lawyers, essentially. They write the laws, and then they go to Parliament, and they pass the law if you get enough people supporting it. So we got a bunch of law lords on our side and got them to write a new act for the United Kingdom. And we grandly called it the Modern Day Slavery Act. And then I started kind of advertising this, and we put it in the Times and the Financial Times, and my strap line for this campaign was, Wilberforce started the resolution, we never finished it. Now we're going to finish it. So we got this report, we got a draft act, and I walked into something called the Cabinet Office in 10 Downing Street and managed to get a meeting with Mr. Cameron, slapped down the report, slapped down the draft law, and by the way, this costs millions usually to get to that stage in the UK, if you go through formal processes, and said, I dare you not to do something about this. Please, tell me you're not going to do anything about it. So he went through it, the whole thing. We got the Prime Minister involved. We got a whole bunch of MPs involved. And within 24 months, we'd gone from a dissolute, fragmented approach to forced labor, modern-day slavery, prostitution, legalized kind of things in the UK that had no right to be legal. And we'd produced in 24 months a new draft law, which was just passed into law 2 months ago in the United Kingdom. So, don't believe that you cannot help, as individuals, as businesses, these fine people to achieve the objective. You've all got the same objective. You know where you want to go. You know where you want to head. You've got guys and ladies that are running businesses out there that are desperate to help you. You've got to show them how to get involved. We've got to show them through the best organization and these fantastic people what they can do. Because if we can align committed people like you with experienced people like them and business, we can change the world. Let's do it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I was tasked to come up here for a little while and talk a bit about how to be an ally. Be like him. But for those of us mere mortals, and for those of us mere men, I think when we recognize that most men don't buy sex, we also must recognize that every man can play a vital role in stopping commercial sexual exploitation and other forms of gender-based violence. And there are some really practical things that we can do as individuals, and I just wanted to talk a bit about some of them. The first is to be aware of the language that we use in our day-to-day conversations. Words like Pete Holmes was talking about before are incredibly powerful and incredibly important, and especially when spoken by people who have power over others through systems of oppression. We live in a society in which words associated with prostitution are often used to put women down. Words like slut, bitch, freak, prostitute, and whore are common. Such language sends a message that women are less than fully human and deserve to be abused. When we see women as inferior, it becomes easier to treat them with less respect and disregard their personhood and ignore their well-being. So be aware of your language, practice right speech, have the courage to interrupt it when you hear it from others, and speak up. You may not witness or hear about sex buying directly, but you will see and you will hear. We all hear every day attitudes and behaviors that degrade women and promote sexual exploitation. When your best friend tells a joke about prostitution, tell him that you don't find it funny. Tell him why. When you read an article that supports the practice of sex buying, write a letter to the editor. Do anything but remain silent. Support survivors of prostitution. Join or donate to organizations like OPS that are working to prevent violence against women. There are rape crisis centers. There are domestic violence agencies. There are anti-trafficking organizations. And there are men's anti-rape programs that all count on donations and all count on volunteer effort. Talk with other men. I know it's terrifying. While we know most men do not buy sex, many think that's okay for those who do. Consider having a conversation with your male friends and your family. Be courageous. Speak up and share what you've learned about commercial sexual exploitation with them. Engage especially with boys and young men. Bring the issue up with them. Let them know how you feel. You can advocate for policies at work Does your place of employment have policies in place to discourage employees from buying sex? Is there a culture of sex buying in your workplace that creates a hostile environment for women? Consider advocating for the institutional changes you need at your workplace to create greater gender equality. You can volunteer with OPS. OPS has an active group of male volunteers. There's actually a number of them that are here tonight who are going to be downstairs at the OPS table after this is over if you want to stop and check in and talk to them. If you have the time and the drive, it's a real wonderful way to make a difference in your community. You can work against other forms of oppression. We don't end prostitution without ending domestic violence. We don't end domestic violence without ending sexual assault. We don't end sexual assault without ending sexual harassment. We don't end sexual harassment without ending racism. We don't end racism without ending homophobia, without ending poverty, without ending the sexual abuse of children. Get active on any one of these issues. Commercial sexual exploitation feeds off all of these other forms of oppression. By speaking out against beliefs and behaviors, including prostitution, that promote one group of people as superior to another and deny other groups their full humanity, you support everyone's equality, including your own. Lastly, and simply, don't buy sex with anyone. No matter what. Although statistics show that most men don't buy sex, the overwhelming majority of sex buyers are male. Make a promise to yourself to be a different type of man, one who values equality and one whose strength is not used for hurting.
I'm going to ask everyone in the audience to please take out their cell phone. And I know you've had, half of you have had it out all along anyway, checking email. But if you'll take it out and if you'll open your calendar, if you don't have a cell phone, if you keep a paper calendar like I do, that'll work too. Would you please mark April 29th lunch on your calendar? One of the ways that you can help support this work is to come join us at our luncheon on April 29th. Stolen Youth is having their third annual luncheon. We have raised in 2 years only because of the tremendous work of our partner, our president, Patty Fleischman, who is chairing again this year, the luncheon, over $1.5 million from starting at zero. That money, the luncheon is completely underwritten, that money goes to support the work that you heard about today in addition to work that Youth Care does. It's tremendously powerful for us to be able to support this innovative work. And it's lovely to be able to hear tonight how government and private sector and business can work together. Now, we're a little past our time. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for caring. Thank you for helping us. Thank you for helping support these extraordinary individuals, both in law enforcement and in the private sector, in business, and in the nonprofit. Please stay tuned. Log on to all the websites. Be informed. Help us. We can change our community.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you appreciate the series, please give us a good review and pass it on to friends. It helps more people find us. You can find more information about Stolen Youth on their website, stolenyouth.org. Stolen Youth presented this panel discussion at Town Hall Seattle on January 26th, 2015. For For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm John O'Brien.